This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
the United Nations says humanitarian needs in refugee camps in Cameroon are increasing, exceeding the means available to take care of the growing number of refugees. But some of the refugees have empowered themselves by making use of resources around them to earn a living for their families.
That's Moki Edwin Kenzaka reporting. Full details on the story coming up.
Also, 17 people are dead and another 15 wounded after a suicide attack in Somalia's capital, Mogadishu. And several dozen women in Kenya say police officers attacked them during this year's election season. And some said they were raped by men in uniform.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, at least 17 people are dead and another 15 wounded after a suicide bomber attacked the main police training facility in Somalia's capital, Mogadishu. Police were rehearsing for an upcoming parade commemorating the 74th anniversary of the creation of Somalia's police force when the bomber entered the General Kahiye Police Academy early today disguised as a policeman. A police officer tells VOA's Somali service they are investigating the possibility the bomber may have spent the night in the academy. But the state-run Somali National News Agency says the man was wearing a tracksuit and emerged from residential areas near the academy before detonating his explosive vest. The militant Islamist group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for the attack, claiming 27 police officers were killed.
The international human rights group Human Rights Watch, HRW, reported that several dozen women in Kenya said police officers attacked them during this year's election season, and some said they were raped by men in uniform. More than 70 people were killed in an election in August, later nullified by the Supreme Court and a repeat presidential poll in October, won by President Uhuru Kenyatta. The opposition boycotted the repeat poll and said it would not be fair. The HRW report said the sexual attacks, mostly on women, occurred over this period in some of Nairobi's slums and in two opposition strongholds, Kisumu and Bungoma, in western Kenya, HRW said in a report. Kenyan police dispute rights groups' allegations that officers used excessive force to quell election-related unrest.
The United Nations says humanitarian needs in refugee camps in Cameroon are increasing, exceeding the means available to take care of the growing number of refugees. But some of the refugees have empowered themselves by making use of resources around them to earn a living for their families. Moki Edwin Kenzaka visited the Gado refugee camp in eastern Cameroon, where 200 refugee women have developed a fish pond by a river and are supplying fish not only to people in the need in the camp, but to surrounding villages.
More than 100 women sing here on the side of a river at Gado near the United Nations refugee camp. It is a day of harvest and many refugees have come to buy. Among the fish farmers is 31-year-old Christine Mbula, a Central African refugee who has been living in the camp for 2 years. Her laughs are indicative of how happy she is to raise money from the sale of the fish and then carry some of her catch home for her family. Mbula says she has come to the river to collect and sell fish so as to help her family. She says the activity has kept them going. Christine says she had been jobless and poor and could not take care of her 3 children. She lost her husband in the fighting in CAR and relied on food aid from the United Nations, which she says was never enough. Boniface Nyadu, head of the World Food Program office in the eastern Cameroon town of Betoa, says the Inland Fish Aquaculture Program was started in the area in June 2017 by the World Food Program to attend to the needs of CAR refugees and their host communities. He says they initiated the project when they noticed that the locality had high fishing potential and at the same time there was insufficient food and a deficit in protein needed by the host communities and refugees. He says they brought groups of 200 refugees and host community members who work in the fishing area for 6 months, harvest and sell the fish, and then create their own fish ponds to help them raise revenue and protein. The refugees and host community members receive business training, emphasizing savings and loan best practices, technical support that includes how to produce low-cost fish and pellets, and other innovative ideas from the World Food Program. The host communities are involved in efforts to stop any potential conflict that may arise from using water and other resources. The WFP says the savings and loan program in Gado is part of a new response to the massive displacement of people from CAR to Cameroon and the effects it has on host communities. Barely 1,000 CAR refugees were here at Gado at the beginning of 2017. Today, close to 25,000 people are seeking refuge and trying to survive as tensions in the Central African state continue. Allegra Bauche, resident coordinator of the UN system in Cameroon, says the aquaculture program was initiated to support the refugees and empower them rather than have them be dependent on resources that are overstretched and slow to come.
Our response is underfunded. We need to remember about the refugees population and the impact this has on the host communities, and we need to be able to do more. Overall, the humanitarian response in Cameroon is 40% funded. When it comes to refugees, that figure goes down to 20%. There's not much we can do with 20% of our funding. After 3 years, what the people are asking us is to give them more long-term support, to start putting them on a path of recovery and of development.
The United Nations raised only $148 million of the $390 million it needed up to the end of last September. The UN says by January, the needs of the refugees will increase to $498 million. CAR plunged into turmoil in 2013 when the government of the majority Christian nation was overthrown by Muslim rebels, setting off a wave of sectarian fighting. Christians, fearing reprisal attacks from the Muslim ex-rebels who controlled Central African Republic, fled for safety. At least 2.2 million are finding it difficult to feed themselves, and in May of this year, the UN Refugee Agency said that there were more than 500,000 internally displaced persons in the country. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Gado, Eastern Cameroon.
South Africa's embattled president has been delivered several stinging rebukes by the courts just days before the ruling party meets to select a new party leader. That puts the African National Congress in an increasing perilous and exciting position. VOA's Anita Powell explains.
In coming days, 5,000 delegates of the African National Congress will meet in Johannesburg to anoint a successor to party leader, South African President Jacob Zuma. For years, he has wallowed in serious, mounting corruption allegations. And just this week, the High Court in Pretoria censured him for trying to evade corruption investigations. As a result of the scandals, Zuma has deeply divided the party, with some top party officials openly calling for him to step down as president. Two figures are officially in the running to replace Zuma as ANC leader: Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa and Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, a party stalwart and experienced diplomat who for 16 years was married to Zuma. But others may emerge when voting begins this weekend. The ANC has won a majority in every national poll since the beginning of democracy in 1994, meaning the new leader is likely to be a strong presidential candidate in 2019. VOA has spoken to numerous analysts and experts, and the only thing they have agreed on is this: anything can happen here. Analyst Ibrahim Fakir says he thinks such uncertainty is a sign of political maturity. He refused to pick a winner.
If I knew, I'd be sailing on the Caribbean. And the uncertainty and the fluidity of it is part of the democratic process. So I think we should accept that because it's a democratic process, because democracy is about contestation, is about democracy, is about competition, because you have competing visions, you have competing candidates, you have competing individuals, the context is fluid, the outcome is uncertain, and that's how it is in democracy.
Zuma supports Dlamini Zuma, and that, says analyst Ralph Matega, could work two ways.
Whoever is being supported or anointed by President Jacob Zuma to lead the ANC, one way or another, it will contribute to some form of extension of his legacy. So members of ANC will have to reflect on that. The court hearing from that point of view will certainly be negative for him. But I do think that upon a very closer observation as to what is happening within the party, there is already a narrative that is set to ignore such kind of decision, such as the court decision against President Jacob Zuma.
Matega also refused to predict a winner, but said that in a way, the leadership contest is only one of the ANC's worries. The conference has yet to begin, and already some analysts are predicting the party schism might cause the event to collapse entirely. Matega says the ANC needs to try to avoid that.
If the ANC cannot hold a conference properly and elect a leader in a free, fair and open manner, it would be quite difficult to trust the ANC to do the same thing within the country.
The conference begins Saturday in Soweto. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Seventeen minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. An international landmine watchdog says new uses of the weapon are extremely rare, but that fighting in Afghanistan, Libya, Ukraine, and Yemen has led to a second consecutive year of high casualties. The International Campaign to Ban Landmines said in an annual report today there were 8,605 casualties, including 2,089 deaths from mines in 2016. That includes improvised explosive devices and unexploded ordnance that are triggered like mines. Of those casualties, 78% were civilians, and the total included the most child casualties ever recorded. They took place in 52 countries. The report cites 61 states and areas contaminated with mines as of November, and while 33 of those are part of the treaty, only Chile, Mauritania, Peru, and the DRC are on track to meet their deadline for clearing territory of mines.
Ugandans living with HIV/AIDS are concerned about the persistent shortage of antiretroviral drugs. Since July, the government has failed to adequately provide ARVs for the 1 million Ugandans who need them. Some patients have been given alternative medications, while others have to make journeys to healthcare centers weekly to get the drugs. VOA's Catherine Numbi reports from Kampala.
In Uganda, nearly 1.5 million people live with HIV/AIDS, and all about perhaps 500,000 are on antiretroviral treatments. That includes retired soldier Major Rubalamira Ruranga.
I have been living with HIV for 32 years. There is no real cure for HIV, but there are medications in the name of ARVs which can help us to live on. And those medications really work very effectively, because I'm sure if they were not there, I wouldn't be alive today, and I'm as normal as any other man.
However, HIV/AIDS patients are facing a tough time ahead and are worried they could die as shortages of antiretroviral drugs, or ARVs, persist. Daniel Kawoya is one such patient.
Our health workers told us that we can only survive when we are taking ARVs. Without ARVs, we are dead.
Margaret Happy is a communication and advocacy officer at the International Community of Women Living with HIV. She explains some of those ARVs that are in short supply in Uganda's hospitals.
Some of the ARVs that have been out of stock since June are Abacavir, Atenolizumab, Nevirapine for pediatrics, Lopinavir for pediatrics, tenofovir, lamivudine, and efavirenz. This is actually a combination which is given out also for the mothers.
The Uganda AIDS Commission blames the shortage of ARVs on the increased enrollment of people needing them. This follows the introduction of the test and treat policy, where each person who tests positive to HIV is put on treatment. The former policy required that only patients whose so-called helper cells, called CD4s, drop below a given level. The new approach drops that requirement. CD4s are an indication of the health of an individual's immune system and its ability to suppress the HIV virus that causes AIDS. Dr. Carol Nakazi is the head of HIV prevention at Uganda AIDS Commission. She says the budget for the ARV drugs has remained the same despite the introduction of the new policy.
We had projected ARVs for the other guidelines, but with test and treat now we are having shortages. The other guidelines we used to say that the people would put on drugs should have a CD4 below 500. By the new guidelines, test and treat says give ARVs whoever tests positive irrespective of their CD4 count.
Today, more than 330,000 more people are receiving HIV treatment than the 728,000 counted 2 years ago. Health workers warn that the shortage of the ARVs is likely to create drug resistance, which is way more expensive to handle and thus increase number of HIV/AIDS-related deaths. Dr. John Sally is the National Medical Director with Uganda Cares, a non-government organization handling people living with HIV.
Risks are high that patients might not even take for the 2 weeks because they are not sure of the tomorrow. They'll end up developing resistance, and resistance leads to failure. The virus will partially be suppressed, and as a result, a patient can end up succumbing to death.
Esther Mbayo is Uganda's Minister of the Presidency. She acknowledges that the issue of drug shortages needs to be addressed urgently.
There is inadequate supply. For example, somebody who has been getting the ARVs on a monthly basis is encouraged to receive for only 1 week and then he goes back. So now, that inconvenience of going back four times in a month is what is causing all that problem. But we are working around the clock as government to ensure that there is restocking with immediate effect.
The test and treat policy is part of the campaign by the World Health Organization. It aims to have 90% of the people living with HIV in the world know their HIV status, and for 90% of those diagnosed with HIV to receive sustainable antiretroviral therapy. Finally, the policy calls for 90% of those infected to have a suppressed viral load by 2020. Experts warn that government of Uganda might not achieve the target if it does not increase HIV/AIDS funding. Uganda only contributes 7% to AIDS financing, with 93% of the budget coming from donations. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
It didn't take long for speculation to begin that China, Zimbabwe's main trade partner, was involved in the recent removal of Robert Mugabe as president of the nation. The ties between his replacement Emmerson Mnangagwa and business people and politicians in China added fuel to the fire. But political analysts who monitor relations between the giant of the Far East and Africa dismiss conspiracy theories that China was a catalyst for political change in Zimbabwe. Darren Taylor reports.
The close relationship between military and party elites in China and Zimbabwe goes back to the 1970s, when Zimbabwean liberation forces fought whites-only rule. Kobus van Staden is a senior foreign policy researcher at the South African Institute of International Affairs.
Several ZANU-PF senior leaders were trained in China, including Emmerson Mnangagwa, the new president.
He says the Mugabe regime's bonds with China grew stronger after the United States instituted financial sanctions in the early 2000s in response to Zimbabwe's human rights violations. Van Staden says the Chinese were very visible in Zimbabwe under Mugabe.
Notably, they built a new parliament building. They heavily invested in some of the extractive industries in Zimbabwe. They are a client of the Zimbabwean agriculture sector, so they buy a lot of tobacco. Retail and other smaller Chinese companies are also involved in Zimbabwe. So the involvement is more complex than it looks, you know, from the outside. It's less simply big companies riding in and taking resources, and it's a more fine-grained engagement.
So Van Staden understands why some see a hidden Chinese hand behind recent events. For one thing, Chinese firms have made the new president and some military commanders wealthy with diamond mining contracts. A visit to Beijing by the army general who led the operation against the Mugabe government, Constantino Chiwenga, also bolstered rumors of Chinese involvement. Chiwenga was in China just days before the army took control of the government.
There is probably a pretty good chance China was probably informed that this is going to happen before. However, that does not mean that China had any kind of active role in making it happen.
Van Staden says China's record in Africa shows it doesn't instigate regime change. He also points out that China is more heavily invested in places that are much more volatile than Zimbabwe, such as South Sudan, but it doesn't interfere there. What the events in Zimbabwe rather reveal, says Van Staden, is China's growing influence on world events.
China is now on a level in Africa where it is informed of these kind of things beforehand. China is now occupying a position in Africa on the same level as the US or the UK. As the West retreats from multilateralism, China is interested in stepping into some of those roles.
Van Staden says the relationship between China and Zimbabwe had become strained in recent years because of Zimbabwe's failure to settle debt. But indications are that this tension is easing under Mnangagwa. For instance, China signed a deal to refurbish the airport in Harare and quickly sent senior envoys. He says Beijing has made clear they want a friendly relationship. And he says there's no difference between China's presence in Zimbabwe and that of other countries.
The Western characterization of China as being these kind of robbers of Africa is very self-serving, especially because many European and American companies are involved in exactly the same sectors in exactly the same way as Chinese competitors.
He says China's record in Africa shows that it adapts to whatever political and economic systems it finds and is unlikely to impose any conditions on Zimbabwe.
I think China is not going to go anywhere. It's going to probably become an even more prominent partner to Zimbabwe.
And so too are other nations, says Van Staden, should the fledgling president keep his promises of reforms. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Misha Dubinsky, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Interested in deeper analysis of news and events in Africa? Then plan to join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. So plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And Our 5 minutes newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.